Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. My name's Alex and I'm your host today. And today I'm sitting down with Glenn Azar. Now, Glenn has been a medic in the Army about, what was it?
Long time ago. I've been out for 11 years.
So I've been out for a while now. And he does an incredible amount of things in his spare time now, if he ever does have a spare time, running an adventure company and a personal development company as well. And we're going to have a chat today about his experience as a medic in the Army, and then also talking about how we can become the best types of paramedics that we can be by utilizing things like personal development in our own lives to try and translate that over. How does that sound?
It sounds awesome.
Awesome. So, Glenn, your experience as a medic in the Army, do you want to go through a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I did my first, what they would call the basic medics course in the Army. I started that in 1992, and so that was by default. So I actually started out as an infantry soldier in the Army, which is what people would expect a soldier to be, like a gunfighter, more or less. I injured myself, I broke my leg, which we were talking about before we started this show, and through that process, I broke my leg in two places doing a bayonet assault course. All I ever wanted to be back in those days was a gunfighter. I didn't understand anything else. I didn't care about anything else. I was a kid. But long story short, I went to the Army came to me and said, you've got two options. One is to be a medical admin, which I was never going to do, and one is to be a medic, which I didn't want to do either. But I chose the medical route out of those two because it was a more hands-on role, and it turned out to be the best decision of my life, hands down. And I never would have made that decision if the option was mine. But anyway, I went away. So back then, we used to do an 18-month course, which is, we weren't civilly aligned, but basically it's like level four paramedics courses, very hands-on, heavy in theory as well, and then you go out and do jobs. And we work with paramedics, we work with AMBOs, we work in hospitals. We can literally travel around the world getting experience, and I was quite fortunate to do whatever I wanted to do, even before I was qualified. Then you go on and you spend a bit of time working within the military, and I joined the military in the 90s when we'd come off 20 years in the Army of no deployments. So since Vietnam, nothing had happened. So all the guys that were training us hadn't really been anywhere. So all of their experience had to be gained working with AMBOs in the civvies, you know, working in the streets. Whereas now, so mid-90s, we started a heavy tempo. We started deploying left, right and centre, and I did deployments that were 8 and 9 months long. In fact, in 98 and 99, both years, I spent 9 months of the year away on deployments overseas in war-torn countries. So now you've got 20-plus years of really well-qualified medics working in extreme circumstances. They're also given civil qualifications, so they kind of align. But we work under some absolutely extreme circumstances where we're the only medical people out there. So it's a different world for us now. But anyway, I went on and did that. And when I came back from Timor, the Army paid for me to do a nursing degree as well. So I went on and did my nursing degree. So I specialised in aviation medicine, Iroquois helicopters initially, and then Black Hawks. It's in the Army, everything is trial by fire. So I was 19 when I dealt with my first death on my own. So, and it was someone that we found on an Army base who had died as a result of an accident. And I had no idea what I was doing, if I'm really honest. Like, the guy was dead, but it took me a lot of years to actually end up processing that. I was involved in a Black Hawk accident within 6 months of that, where two soldiers were killed and nine were wounded. And it was that was out at Oakey. So I was still a teenager dealing with this stuff. So I thought, or maybe I just turned 20, but I thought that, you know, I was tough and I knew how to handle that stuff. But you look back years later and you realise we didn't do any sort of decompression post those incidents. I just met a mate of mine only this year. I hadn't seen him in 25 years. And we were involved in those two incidents together. And we were just talking about how they shaped us and problems they caused for us and whatnot. But anyway, you just deal with that stuff initially and you keep just going on and doing things. But that was kind of my career right through until 2009 when I got out.
That's really interesting. And considering you just said that you were only 19, 20 when you're experiencing these for the death for the first time, a lot of the students that are coming straight out of school, going straight onto placement and experiencing death for the first time, like I experienced death, you know, when I was 19 on my first ever placement. And you just said that you didn't have those skills for decompression afterwards or anything. How, looking back now, how would you deal with that or cope with that?
Well, there's probably a couple of things I would say now. So back then, myself and this other guy, and we were a year apart. So the first death, I was 19, he was 20, and there was no one senior. We were it. And, you know, it was meant to be quiet there. Someone had fallen down like an internal shaft inside a building and had broken his neck. We got caught out to it. I remember going down this shaft with a fireman who was above me, and there was nowhere to stand, and this guy's head had fully turned around. So he was clearly dead. But I remember coming out and telling the officers that he was dead. I was a private soldier, and they call in the civilian coroner. And I remember sitting there. This is like 2 o'clock in the morning. And because I was on a night shift, and I was the only one there with this other mate of mine, just the two of us. And I remember sitting there and thinking, what if the coroner gets here and says, this guy's dead now, but if you had done something half an hour ago, even though I knew he was dead, this started playing on my mind that what if I'm wrong? And yet it was, even now, I know that it was clearly the right call, but you still have that doubt. Then we came home, back to the medical base. This was only out at Oakey, so just west of Brizzy. We did the cleanup of all the stuff once we'd pulled the body out of the shaft, and then we just went home. And I got a phone call that afternoon from an officer just checking in, going through some administrative stuff. There was a note that we hadn't cleaned the stretcher correctly. There was a bit of blood still left on it. But no one asked if we were okay. And to be honest, I felt okay, but no one talked about it. No one said, you might have some, because I did have in hindsight, I had a few dreams about, did I make the right call? What if we'd gotten there earlier? All of those sort of things. And no one asked you about that. No one said, this is some of what you're going to think about or go through. And in the military in particular, you just act tough. You show up. It was a very alpha dominant, male or female is irrelevant. It's just an alpha dominant type area to work in, particularly back in those days. So you wouldn't dare put your hand up and say you were struggling. And in fairness, I wasn't struggling, but there was no one senior. We were the most senior people there. So that was the first mistake. And I'm sure that wouldn't happen again. I think that was just a sign of those times back then where nothing's going to happen tonight. This bloke's been a medic for a year. He's good enough. And I wasn't. I wasn't good enough if something had happened. And then it was within 6 months we had that Black Hawk crash. We did have more decompression after that because it was a big incident. It was the first Black Hawk crash that had taken fatalities in the world. They were thought to be an uncrashable aircraft, which is obviously there's no such thing, but that was the thought. There were so many people involved, but one of the senior medics is one of the best medics I ever worked with, a guy by the name of Andrew Barter, who I still think about to this day, phenomenal medic. He had that incident and then two or three other incidents, and within 18 months he'd taken his own life. Now, again, I'm 20 years old. I didn't really consider why he took his own life until years later. I'm still friends with his partner, his ex-partner, and we still talk about that day here and there because this guy was the good-looking, Mr. Popular, funny, very, very good medic. He was the first person in the military to go through and do the full paramedic level 4, level 5 courses to work out how we bring those courses in line with us. And so he was the man. Like, he was the one that everyone wanted to be. If there was a big incident, he was the guy that you sent out. And the problem we had was we sent him out to too many things and no one decompressed him. And the military wasn't always good at that. You just man up and go about your business. So my advice to young people now, and I think we're better at this, but is actually reach out. And even if you feel okay, still speak to someone, because you should. Because we put ourselves in harm's way as far as dealing with death. That's the kind of work that you're going into. And we choose that. But we also still have to be conscious that not many people, there are people maybe not listening to this podcast, but there are people out there that have never seen a dead body because they're not in those lines of work. And the first death they'll see might be a family member. But for us, we elect to put ourselves in harm's way in that area from a mental point of view, day in, day out. So you've got to accept that every day that you go to work, the potential is most likely you've got a very high opportunity of seeing death. And you have to be able to deal with that and not just assume that it's normal, because it's not. I don't think it is that normal.
Absolutely. And that was a good point before when you said, you know, even if you are okay, it's important to talk to someone. That seems to be a major recurring theme throughout this podcast, talking to people who are very experienced in those really high stress situations, like all of our microflight paramedics. They've all mentioned that. So I think that's really important, that takeaway for all of our students listening to this. But going from there, a major part of this podcast is talking about where the profession can sort of take you. And I guess when you left the army, even when you were in the army, if I'm correct, you started doing a lot of adventure stuff on the side, and then ended up turning it into your own business. How do you think that, I guess, medic side of it played into that?
So I'll just very quickly, just because it kind of hit me while you're talking, take back one step, which is about dealing with stuff, and then I'll come to that. So to me, dealing with stuff, yes, even if you feel okay, talk about it. But another key sign is if you're coping through drugs or alcohol. You know, if you're dealing with something in a way, or if you find that you're drinking more or resorting to even, you know, prescribed drugs, but in a way that you know is not healthy. In our industry, we need to be smart enough to recognize that. Then, yeah, go and get help. But, yeah, how medically what I did led me into the adventure industry is really interesting, because I was sitting in the army. They allow us as medics not to just sit on base doing nothing, because we can't do that. Like, for us to keep our skills up, for anyone listening to this show to keep your skills up, you've got to be doing stuff. If you take a year off, you're rusty at the end of the day, because it's a skill that you've got to constantly be working on. And so we could put a hand up and go and work in hospitals. Like I said earlier, we could go and work for AMBOs. We could do stuff. And these other ex-army guys sent out a bit of a notice to all the medics in the area saying, we're looking for an aviation qualified medic to go across the Kokoda Trap. And this is before anyone was doing Kokoda. So this was late 90s, 99, 2000, somewhere in there. So not many people were trekking Kokoda. Like, when I say not many, I'm talking like a few hundred people a year. It wasn't really well known. And they reached out because they were taking all of the head executives from Westpac. So when you work out what those executives are getting paid, they're quite a high commodity for that organisation to let go. Millions of dollars worth of commodity walking across the track. So they put safety parameters. And one of them was, we want an adequately qualified medic who can get them out of there. So they just sent out a flyer. And I was the first aviation qualified medic to get back. And I contacted my commanding officer, said, can I go and do this thing? Because they think, well, that's good for you to keep your skills up. I literally did nothing for 10 days because no one got injured. And I've done, as you know, 79 Kokoda track crossing since. And I think the worst injuries I've had really have been rolled ankles. I had one appendicitis once, but nothing that really required me to be an aviation qualified medic. But I got my look in. So I went over and did that Kokoda trip. And then those guys would contact me a couple of times a year, and my commanding officers would let me go. Because it's got military significance, it's 10 days, there's nothing much else happening on base, and they would let you go. And then from that I started thinking, I could do this for a job one day, if that's a thing. And then I slowly, as it got to the stage of getting out of the army, had launched my own business called Adventure Professionals, which pre-COVID was a very strong business. Obviously it's doing nothing these days until COVID lifts, but yeah, I just got to go out and have all these experiences. And even now, I can run trips and I can take medics and paramedics and anyone over on trips with me. And I say to them, we always take a medic, but I always say to them, nothing exciting is really going to happen, but we still like to take one for a safety parameters. Now, there's no way in the world. I've been to Russia, South America, Nepal, Africa, up in the Yukon, as you know, dog sending, PNG, all because I had a paramedic qualification that I didn't even want, because I wanted to be a gunfighter in the army. So I'm quite fortunate in that one thing led to another thing led to another thing. And I think in this day and age, for people listening to this show who are obviously, I would imagine, all students or very new in their careers, you have no idea the scope of where you can go. What we're learning through COVID, for example, is that the whole world shut down except medical, because we need more medical people to do stuff. So there are opportunities. I've got a mate that literally maybe 3 weeks ago flew to Africa and took up a 3-month contract over there. So, and people are going, how are you flying? Well, we're critical, we're needed. And he said all he got was a letter from the organisation he was going to work with, and pretty much no one questioned him. It was just, cool, you got the qualification to go through, come into the country, and off he went, travelled through Dubai. Like, everyone's jealous because he's out doing stuff, but we're needed. We're always going to be critical. I don't think we will have technological updates in our industries, but we'll never replace people. You can't. Like, people have to be able to run the machines. People have to be able to make human connections with other people to make them feel good, because that's a massive part of treating someone, is how they feel. And that means that they feel cared for and connected, and someone's actually makes them feel relaxed that we're doing the best we can and you're a good chance of getting through this, as opposed to being on their own. That's not going to get replaced by a robot anytime soon, I don't think.
No, absolutely not. No, that's really interesting, and you're right. Even talking to Sonny Steve Whitfield, he's one of the he is the founder of Medics Beyond Borders, which was Wild Medic, and doing similar things. So just going off and not having the blinkers, I guess, about just being state ambulance focused, being open to going anywhere. In fact, the other week he was just on doing a Shark Week expedition as a medic. You just don't think of these things as a student.
It's funny you'd say that. Even when I was deployed to countries like, you know, in Timor or Bougainville in the North Solomons, or there was no medical facilities at all. So it was only us. But then very quickly after us arriving, Medicine Sands Frontiers, Medicine Jumondo, all those places would come in, and they're all doctors, nurses, paramedics who volunteer their time for up 1 to 3 months, and they go and work in these countries and help people. You know, we travel around the world, and every state and every organization, it's changed a little bit, but would always have all of their rules, so you can't, but we're just, humans are humans. Like, the human body doesn't change. No. It's just there are a few different ways that maybe different countries do things. And I know, as a registered nurse, at one stage, like, I couldn't work as a Queenslander, I couldn't work in New South Wales. But now that we have national registration, that is changing. But it was silly. Like, you'd have to, if you move states, you'd have to do a 6 or a 9 month course to be up to, and it's crazy. You've literally just finished a degree. So, and I think that's all changing. And even now, as you would know, you can go over to the UK, and the timeframes to get skilled over there, because they need to check on you to make sure that you are who you say you are and you can do what you say you can do. But that's a lot quicker. It's expedited. You're working with people who get to, you know, say, yeah, as opposed to what they used to make you do is like 6 months of admin back in a university to prove that you've got the ability to pass this course, which was crazy. So that's changing. But I've literally run into amazing people all around the world working with other people to help them just based off that qualification. Like, so I've got a mate currently sitting in Africa doing some pretty cool work. I've got a couple of ex-army mates over there at the moment, in the same place doing stuff, you know, it's pretty cool. And they're not even getting paid that much. It wasn't about that for them, but there was certainly plenty of paid work too.
Absolutely. That's really cool. Mm-hmm. It's amazing the amount of people you start talking to and the different opportunities that are available to people.
This is life, right? And you know, I'm into personal development. So the opportunities for people listening are literally limited to your own imagination and what you want to do. So, and you might be doing your course now a year or 2 years in and not sure where you want to specialise or what you want to do, and that's okay. But as you go out and start getting experiences, you'll start to think about what opportunities are available to you, and the limitation will literally be yourself, how good you're willing to be, how hard you're willing to work, how much you really want something. That's all it's going to be.
Absolutely. And now, I guess, taking that towards that personal development side, what made you want to go from you're a medic in the army, you've gone, done some adventure, created your own company, and then you go on, hang on, this personal development thing's kind of cool.
So to give people a full background, while I was in the army, I was dual-rolled as a physical training instructor. So the physical development of soldiers to go to war, effectively, or if they're injured, to rehab them, much like an athlete, a star athlete, we have to rehab our people so they can do their jobs. So that was that side. So then I started, while I was at university, training to make money on the side. I started running physical training for civilians. I'd never worked with civilians because I'd been in the army since I was a kid. And so then I started to enjoy that. And I realized that's just personal development. And a lot of people come into a gym and try and get physically healthy, but there's more to it. There's normally something going on they don't like about themselves or about life that they're trying to fix, for example. And physical outlets are a good way to do that. And then I started running adventures, as we mentioned, and when I started doing that full time, I realised that adventure is the best personal development in the world. Who you are at the start of an adventure versus who you are at the end is two different people. You go out on the Kokoda Track, for example, or you go and climb Mount Kilimanjaro, and you have to deal with whatever weather conditions get thrown at you, whatever's happening for you. You might feel sick, you might roll an ankle, whatever. You've still got to go out and deal with all of that. And you realise as an animal, we're fairly small in the grand scheme of nature, and you just deal with what nature throws you. So I think it's the best personal development in the world. And so that naturally started to lead itself, those two, fitness and adventure side, into the mindset side, because I'm dealing with people, like the youngest person I've taken to Kokoda was an 8-year-old, and the oldest person I've taken was 79, and everyone in between. And both of them were fine. And then I've had a 30, 35-year-old, relatively fit guys and girls struggle. And I think the only difference can be mindset. And so what I had to learn to do was to help people with their mindset to get them through an adventure, knowing that you could fly them out, but if you did that, they're not going to get the full experience. And so often I've had people say, can you, like, I want out of here, this is too hard, or it wasn't what I expected, and I convince them to stay and work through it. And always, I would say 100% of the time, those people have thanked me for not giving up on them. So then they've now learnt more about themselves and what they're capable of. And now I run a company or a business called the Building Better Humans Project, which, as you know, started as a podcast, but really it's just launched into, literally, as we record this 2 days ago, we launched a new website called the buildingbetterhumansproject.com.au. You know, taking people to Russia and climbing the highest mountain in Russia, just everyday people, that's personal development. They're getting uncomfortable. They're having to be in a country that doesn't speak English, particularly when you're out on the border of Syria there. No one speaks English. You're kind of the minority, and they don't apologize for that either. It's just, this is who we are, and you deal with it. Then you've got to deal with altitude. You know, it's 5,600 meters above sea level. You've got to deal with freezing cold. It's like minus 20 degrees. You've got to deal with all of that stuff, and they come back different people. And so that naturally led itself into that personal development field. And now I'm studying a psychology degree. And that's not because I want to be a psychologist. It's because I'm a lifelong learner. And if I would encourage anyone, I didn't go to uni the first time till I was 30. And I'd encourage anyone who's currently at uni, obviously listening to this, to dedicate yourself to a lifetime of learning. Not necessarily formally, but just always be learning, because I don't know, there's so much available to us in the world, and I only woke up to that at the age of 30, and I'm nearly 50 now. And I think, wait, imagine if I'd woken up to that at 20 or whatever, like young people like yourself who are already doing that stuff. When I was 20, well, I was in the army, but I didn't think that I would ever go to uni or that I would even want to. And to be truthful, I only did it because the army said to me, that's a natural progression. I did it because when I was in the army, we dealt with 18 to 35-year-olds. And when I was in, it was mostly male who were deployed, so they didn't deploy women originally. Now it's open to everyone. So we would learn 18 to 35-year-old relatively fit guys and girls, mostly with traumatic wounds, be it gunshots. Obviously, that's what we do. Then when we got in countries, we do what we call hearts and minds, which is dealing with babies and the elderly and delivering babies. But we weren't trained for that. And yes, we have some nurses who come over with us and some doctors, but when you're out in the field, sometimes there might be a team of, say, 30, which is a platoon, and there might be between 1 and 3 medics, paramedics, and that's it in the whole team. And so when there's a baby that needs to be delivered, everyone looks at you. You've got a red cross on your arm. You've got no skill in that area. You've got a satellite phone back to the nearest doctor who's 5 hours away trying to get advice. So when I came home and they offered me a nursing degree, I thought, yeah, I'll do that because I need more skills. Because I hadn't – obviously paramedics learn all that stuff, but the army medics didn't. In those days, we do now, mostly because our courses are civilian qualified, or people can now do paramedics courses and then join the military. Obviously, they bring all the skills across with them. But in when I went through, it was just dealing with our own people in wartime. So I had to learn a lot in that process. But the other side of personal development for me was working in third world countries. I've had a guy who's got stabbed in the chest, collapsed his lung, and then got in a boat from one island to the next and rode for 5 hours to get to us. And one of my young soldiers at the time said, how did he even do that? And I said, well, his other option was to die. So it made me realize how incredibly strong the human will can be and how much we can achieve even under duress. I had a lady that was 39 weeks pregnant who broke her foot, and she walked nearly 40 kilometers to get to us because we were the only medical facility on the whole island. And this is in the North Solomons. And again, how do they do that? And we end up performing a cesarean because we had a full operating theatre set up out of tents. But she knew that she was under duress with the birth, but also with the fact that she'd injured herself. So she just walked to us. I had a guy that got shot 3 times with an M16. We do live blood transfusions in the field. So if you and I went to war together, everyone would be blood grouped, and you'd work out who can transfuse to who, because you can't just carry a blood bank with you. Obviously, it doesn't last. And so you're under slightly different ways of operating. And so this guy got shot 3 times. He had 4 units of blood put into him. 2 came out of me because I matched him, and 2 came out of, we're the only 2 that matched him. So 2 came out of each of us. So that's, as most people know, you don't normally give up 2 units of blood. And it took weeks for my body to recover. But again, I learnt what humans are capable of. All of those stories I tell you about those 3 people in particular, they're all on Panadol post-operatively. Like, that's ludicrous to think that that's okay. But they'd never had pain relief before other than, you know, bush alcohol or medicines they were taking. So we were giving them Panadol, and that was enough. You know, like a lady's having a cesarean and she's on Panadol. A guy's shot 3 times and he's on Panadol. It's crazy. But that's what humans are capable of if we allow ourselves to understand and believe that we are an animal that has the ability to survive. In Western society, we've come a little bit softer, obviously, because we've become comfortable, and COVID's probably proven that, that we don't really like it when we've been challenged in the way that we have. But the people listening to this show are going to be at the forefront. You're going to meet people at their worst. And that's why you need to be at your best. And you owe that to them every time. You owe that to them with the energy that you bring to a situation. And the way to deal with that, I think, is to constantly be working on personal development. How do I make myself better? Not necessarily just as a paramedic, but just as a person in general. How do I make myself happier, feel more fulfilled, feel more confident with who I am? Because your energy won't lie. If you feel good about yourself, the energy you pass on to other people will be good. You will run into, as student paramedics, you'll run into elderly, and when I say elderly, people that have been in the industry 20 plus years who hate the job, who bring a bad energy to patients, to other people, and they're already at their worst, and then you bring that energy to them as well. And it's the same in nursing. I experience this in both sides. But you'll also run into people that have been doing it for that long who still love it, and they're still bringing a really good energy. And you can see the difference in the way a patient responds by the energy that's brought to them, even if they're in a really bad situation. Because when you bring a good energy, they feel confident that they're in good hands and someone's actually trying to save them. And you'll notice that time and time again. The trick for you as a student paramedic is to look to the good people, not the bad. Don't be jaded by the people that are jaded by their job. It's every job. It's school teachers. It's people who serve you coffee. You run into good and bad everywhere. Your job is to be one of the good.
Definitely. And that's a thing that's come up quite a bit, actually, with the paramedics that we have asked this sort of question. And they mentioned that even if you can't find that really positive person that's in the profession that you look up to, surrounding yourself, not just around people, but including things like podcasts, like books, anything that is positive in the field that you can take on board and use as sort of a guide. Because public perception is everything in this job. You know, as soon as you wear a uniform, all eyes are on you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important. Most people will groan when you say, oh, self-help, self-development, you know, why would I have to do that? How does it even like relate to what I'm doing? But even in the last episode of season 1 with Dan Cooper, he mentions that just to have a competitive edge on anything you do in life, it's important just to look at yourself and have your basic things like sleep, nutrition, and exercise. They're the little things that matter, because if you're creating those really good habits in your own life, in the basic things, then they will translate to all other aspects.
Yeah, so we say that energy doesn't lie. And so, yeah, when you walk into our building here where we're recording, the first sign says be responsible for the energy you bring into this place. And I think that's true of every situation. Like, you're choosing to go into a tough profession, and you know that, and you accept that, and there's a reason you chose it. And hopefully it's for more than just money, even though you can get paid well to do it, but hopefully it's more about serving humanity, which is what I believe we are as first responders, whether it's, you know, police, fire, paramedics, nurses, military, we're all first responders. Essentially, we choose to serve the people that we look after. So therefore, we can never bring an energy that makes it feel like they're a pain in our backside, because you literally chose to serve, and that's the job. And so if you bring a good energy, then obviously you get a better result from people. You give them hope. But the way you bring a good energy is by looking after yourself first, because, as I say, you can't fill from an empty cup. So you have to be filling your own cup, and you're in a trade and an industry that does take from your cup a lot. It requires a lot of your energy, and a lot, and you are going to go home and feel exhausted sometimes, and you are going to go home and feel beat up. You know, one of my best friends in the world was a paramedic who then moved into nursing in ICU, And the stuff, like the amount of death you deal with in ICU is quite high compared to, because it's obviously that's the industry, I guess, something like 40% higher than any other area in healthcare. And I just remember it just used to beat her up sometimes, dealing with young people, dealing with, you know, someone dying the day before Christmas, dealing with old people who aren't connected to family anymore and there's no one that comes to see them. That stuff beats you down. Absolutely. And so you've got to have the ability to put as much good stuff into your head as possible, which is why I am a believer in podcasts. I am a believer in audiobooks, finding go-to videos on YouTube that make you feel inspired or better about yourself, or having a musical playlist. There's a concept which I know you would have heard of from a guy called Brendan Burchard in High Performance Habits, which he uses as a morning ritual, as a routine going to and from one job to another, or one in his case, it could be answering emails through to having a meeting through to standing on stage talking. But for paramedics, it's going from this one job where you pick someone up and you carry out the treatment and you get them all the way back to hospital and you release them. He calls this clearing tension and setting intention before you get back into your vehicle. And it could be cleanup time. Your job there is to clear the tension that you've just received. Even if you don't feel it, there's a natural build-up tension by the intensity of what we do. And so that could be listening to good music while you're cleaning your vehicle and getting your stores restocked. It could be listening to a podcast. It could be just having a good conversation with someone and an honest conversation with someone about, well, that was pretty heavy and that made me feel a certain way. Whatever that clearing the tension is. And then setting your intention, which is my intention when I go to the next job is to be fully present for this person, because they don't know what I've been through today or this week and they deserve me to be fully present because I've been called out for a reason. Now, I've been called out. I remember when I was working up in Toowoomba in the ambulance, and you'd get called out to, like, the elderly, you know, first thing in the morning or in the afternoon, which is when a lot of the elderly have problems, like, you know, when they wake up in the morning or whatever, you'd get called out. And sometimes the call outs would be a waste of time. So you'd get there and it would just be kind of a false alarm. And people sometimes, senior paramedics even, and I was in the army, so I had a different energy about it, I guess, but as soon as you get called out, they would look at the age and go, oh, this will be another one of those. But you don't know that. And even if it is, sometimes these people are just lonely and they don't have anyone. And if they feel a little bit nervous or panicked about something, hey, that's our job too. When we get there, yes, I get that it's a resource, but that's not for us to deal with. For us to deal with is a person in front of us, how they're feeling in this moment and what energy I bring to them, as opposed to on the way there assuming already that it's just going to be a waste of my time. And I remember listening to one guy in particular, and he would do that all the time, and I didn't like working with him as a result, because one, I was volunteering, I wasn't being paid to work there. When you work as a military, you're just like an extra and you've got good skills and they like to use you. But I used to think, if I was in trouble, I would not want this guy coming to save me if that's his energy and that's what he'd be like. And he was very good at what he did when he got there. Like, he was very clinically good at what he did. He just didn't have a great connection with people. And you could see the difference in energy just by talking to people and having a chat to them and knowing their story. And, you know, me having done so many Kokodas and having a military history, I remember picking up a guy, oh, this is probably about 12 years ago, so I was still in the army, and he was in his 90s, and we just got chatting, and he did need help, but we just got chatting, and it turned out he'd fought on the Kokoda track, and I was like, wow. And I'd only done a handful of Kokodas back then, but I was still in the army, and because I was in uniform, because we still wore our military uniform, he just was talking my ear off about the experiences he had had, and it was really cool. And when we were driving there, this same paramedic was going, this guy, we get calls for this guy at least once a month. And it's never anything. And I think, well, in his 90s, it's probably something. Anyway, I can't remember what the actual case was, but I just remember him being that excited that I was in uniform and we got to talk military stuff. And I just thought, if you knew this guy's story, if you know anyone's story, there's probably a lot of value in getting to know someone as opposed to just they're a name, they're a number, they're a symptom. So what's the symptom? What are we dealing with here? And you've dealt with those paramedics. I'm sure if you've been on a practical, you've experienced it where it's just, they literally are just the number and the symptom. And then you go on to the next job, and then you go on to the next job. So my idea is that clearing tension, setting intention to be fully present for each person that I deal with, whether this is a 15-minute false alarm case and they're okay, or this takes me an hour of, you know, doing whatever on the side of the road until we get them back to it, whatever. It doesn't matter what the situation is. I've literally worked like rural, out west. I've worked in countries where we're, like, say, 5 hours away from the nearest medical facility, and you've got to be the paramedic for 5 hours with someone. That's a lot of workload. That's pace, when you think about it, it's a whole shift by the time you start and finish and clean up, and you've got to decompress, you've got to do all of that stuff, but you've got to have the ability to clear the tension at the end of the day. I try to do it, and for young paramedics, won't get this just yet, but try and clear your tension before you walk into your house. So if you're in a relationship and you've got kids, you don't want to take that tension into the house. If you're living at home still, you don't want to take that tension in. And I'm not saying don't talk about the things you go through, but don't bring the tension of that stuff. You've got to clear the tension, set your intention to be fully present when you get home and be open and talk about that stuff, but not in a way that brings everyone else down and brings your energy down as well. There's a lot. If anyone's interested in that stuff, read the book High Performance Habits. He goes heavily into that, because why wouldn't you want to be a high performer in your field, whether it's paramedicing or anything else?
Exactly. And that's similar to that third space sort of concept of having something between you and the job, in which you may, you know, it might be that you bike ride from home to work, or and vice versa, just to clear that what's happened during the day and just separating yourself before you walk in the door.
Yeah, so the end of the day. So Brandon Bouchard will say that when he pulls into his driveway, if he hasn't felt like he's cleared the tension yet, he'll listen to a set piece of music, like a playlist or something, and he'll just go through some deep breathing, like some box breathing or some sort of exercise. And occasionally, if that hasn't worked, he said he'll get out of his car and just walk a lap or two laps around the block, just to breathe the fresh air, listen to his music in his AirPods, and so he feels like he's lifted up his own energy and he's cleared a bit of tension. Then he walks through the door, so he can be fully present. And just from a psychological point of view, for people listening, if there's young kids in your house, for example, they don't understand work. They don't really understand where you are. It's no different for them than being at school. So if you walk in and you're a parent in particular, or an older brother or sister even, and you walk into the house and you're kind of angry or upset or negative, their natural assumption when they're under the age of 10, their natural assumption is that they've done something, because they assume that when you're outside, you are happy. And then as soon as you walk through the front door, you're not happy, and the only thing that changed is me. And that's what they take on. And when you understand that concept, it's a psychological concept, that when you understand that, you will change the way you interact. You'll be more conscious of the energy you walk through the front door, because you don't want a 6 or 7-year-old to feel like they're the cause of you not feeling good. They don't understand that you've just dealt with a really tough case, or potentially a death, they don't get that, and nor should they. They don't need to. But what they do get is that you're distressed and you don't want them to feel like they're the cause of that. So once you understand that, then you can focus on coming in through that front door with a really good energy, and then decompress some other way, whether it's a friend, whether it's talking to your partner, talking to your mum and dad, an hour or two after you get home, give yourself time and space, and then have that conversation with someone else in a really adult, structured way of saying, hey, this is what I went through today. It was really tough, and I'm not really sure how to process it just yet. And you're not looking for someone to fix you or save you. There's nothing wrong with you. It's normal to feel challenged by these situations. You're just looking for someone to listen more than anything else, so you can get things out loud, and that way they're not just bouncing around inside your head. That's my belief about how we look after our mental health. And if you're not looking after your mental health in your first 2, 3, 5 years in these sort of roles, you will become one of those jaded, bitter people, because that's a natural response when you're constantly being challenged. It's a, for want of a better word, it's a mental scar tissue, and eventually it becomes tough and gristled like scar tissue, and it won't go away. And so if you can look after this stuff early, you'll have a long career, you'll impact patients really well, you'll impact the next generation of paramedics. You know, think in 5 years' time, even for you, Alex, there's a whole new generation of paramedics that are going to be feeding off what you teach them and your energy and whether you're still enjoying the job. And the last thing you want as a second-year paramedic student to go, maybe I've picked the wrong job because no one here seems to like their job. What we do is very necessary. The world needs us. And you're going to get patients at their worst, and they're not always going to be nice to you because they're freaking out. And you put it into their mind, they're fighting for their life, and they don't know if you can help them. And so you've got to be okay that sometimes they're not going to be on their best behaviour. But at the other end, I'm sure they appreciate what we do for the most part.
Absolutely. That's a really good way to put it. And just doubling back on what you were saying before about working with that, you know, particular paramedic that, you know, could do his skills really well but wasn't able to connect with patients. A major thing that we keep getting taught is that, well, you can teach skills, but you can't teach attitude. And that just comes with who you are as a person and like what you feed yourself, the positive information and all of that.
Yeah, but you've also got to be responsible for your energy and for your attitude. So I don't think it's okay for someone, and they're probably not listening to this podcast, someone who's got that attitude, but I don't think it's okay for someone with that attitude to go, well, when you've been here 10 years, you'll be like this too. Well, okay, I don't want to be like that. So maybe I need to change something, because that's a fairly common sort of, well, wait, you've done this for X amount of years. Well, no, I get to own my attitude and I get to make some changes to that and some adjustments. But the other thing I do know is that if you surround yourself with the right people and therefore you become the right person, then you'll lift the attitude of the general people or populace around you. So when you get into a team or a work environment where people are high functioning, and Dan Cooper could definitely talk to this because of the roles that he played, but you find that they're all positive, they're all upbeat, there's no one walking around talking, thinking negatives. And so therefore, eventually, when you get into a high-functioning team, and I've been fortunate to have been in a few, literally no challenge seems like too big a challenge for you. You're up for it. You understand what you're doing. And from that point of view, we can actually change, our energy can change other people's energy. Or we can go the other way and just become one of those, yep, I've been here 5 years, so now I'm jaded too. Well, that's a choice. You get to choose that. But I know that if I'm looking for promotion, for longevity in the workspace, for having a bigger impact over a whole career, who do you think people are going to hire the most? Like, if you go everywhere and people go, Alex has got the best attitude as well as being a good paramedic, that's great. Or I've got this other guy or girl that's a great paramedic clinically, could work on their attitude a bit. If you could get that feedback, I know who I'm choosing. You're right. You can't teach attitude. That's has to be owned by the individual, but you can absolutely teach skills. But the other side of that is the people with good attitudes will naturally be trying to upskill constantly anyway, because that's the standard they set for themselves. Like, if you're a true high performer, you will try to be a high performer in every aspect of your life. So the people with a good attitude, I think, are going to be better operators anyway. That's my belief.
Absolutely. And just because I don't want to forget it, there was a nurse at work the other week that told me that, and it really resonated, and I really wanted to share it with people, was that you're there at the end of the day to impact that person's journey through whatever it is you're doing, whether they're in the hospital and you're a nurse, or you're a paramedic and it's pre-hospital. Like, your job is to impact their journey. So it's not how, they're never going to remember what you did, but they're going to remember how you made them feel. And I just thought it was a great reminder in terms of what you were saying about being able to connect with people and bringing a really good energy.
I say that even in the personal development space, or even when I'm running like camps for kids. Like, we had 60 kids in here from a school recently. I don't need them to remember my name, but I want them to remember there was that guy once that told us this thing or that made me feel a certain way. And I would like the same. Imagine if you leave a place and you go, I went up to X hospital, or I was picked up by the paramedics and they were so good. And we've all had that experience where someone just made you feel good. And I can give you a quick example, which I told you off air, but my son Christian's 17. He's autistic and intellectually impaired. He went into surgery because he broke his arm recently. Because he's clumsy. He'll look one way and be going another, but that's another story. But it was very traumatic for us as a family to see him so vulnerable, and he's mentally between the age of 5 and 6, so he doesn't get it. And he was in surgery for 40 minutes longer than expected because they had some complications. And his mum and I are both nurses, and I'm a paramedic as well, and she was also in the army. So we get the whole trade, the industry, what we're doing for each other, but we were still nervous because our little man was having something happen to him. And I remember what made us feel really good was this nurse came out and she introduced herself, and she said, I'm in recovery with, and she named the other nurse. She said, both of us have autistic children on different varying levels on the spectrum. And so when we heard about Christian, we volunteered to take him on. And that made us feel so good. Now, I'm sure every nurse in recovery was going to be good, but it made you feel good to know that they looked at him as not just a number or as a patient. They knew that he had challenges, and they went, hey, we're up for that challenge because we understand it. And as parents, we felt really good about that. And so that's connection for you as a paramedic. Might not even be direct with the patient. It might also be with their mum or dad, or their wife or husband or their kids or whoever else is significantly attached to them, who just wants to know that their loved one is in the best possible hands they can be in. That's the situation you want. They're not going to remember your name because they're under an intense amount of trauma and pressure, but they are going to remember that they were treated really well, and that's a good thing.
Absolutely. That's a really nice story, and, yeah, it's a great reminder as well. Now, I wanted to sort of start to wrap this up, but I wanted to get your insight into for some of the people who've never come across personal development or are just starting out or just heard the concepts and never really considered it. What is, one, the importance of considering it and starting to do it, and how should people start to go about it?
So it's a good question, because the people listening to this show are no doubt at uni under an immense amount of pressure, getting exams done, and you're putting all this information in that's required. So it's easy to go, I do not have time for something else. So that's step number one, and to overcome that barrier. So for me, the importance of it is that we want to be lifelong learners. We want to have a really good energy, and we want to put as much good information inside our heads as possible. But where that ties into you being super busy and having to learn is it can actually be a beneficial and active break from the educational material that you have to try and retain. And it can actually enhance your ability to retain it, because it's like, you know, we exercise hard in the gym and we might want to cool down with just a walk around the block. Well, personal development can be the walk around the block for our brain. It can be, I've been sitting here and I've been working on this assignment or studying for an exam for 3 hours, which is way too long, by the way, for people that cram study. And so what I need to do is walk away. And there's again, in high-performance habits, they talk about having a 10-minute, or it's actually 13 minutes, but let's say 10-minute break every hour, so that you can regenerate, so you can clear the tension of that last hour, set your intentions of what the next hour is going to be about. So even if you're studying or you're working on an assignment and you think, I'm time poor, if you took a break after an hour and you went for a walk for 15 minutes and you just listened to a personal development book or podcast or concept or something that just loosened up your brain a little bit while you're going for a walk, not with the intention of trying to remember it, just taking it in as good information, as entertainment at some level that's got an educational value, then come back in and you've had some fresh air, you've had some good stuff going inside your head, you grab a glass of water or whatever to rehydrate, then you go back to your assignment or your exam study, I will guarantee that you're going to retain more information than you would if you just crammed out 3 to 4 hours straight, because you're giving your brain a break and it needs that. So that's step one, to get overcome that obstacle of I'm already busy enough and I get it. And some people are crazy enough to be doing 2 degrees. And so then they've got even more assignments and more study and more whatever. Just understand this, in the space that you're in as paramedics, the learning never stops. You're constantly, so don't think I'll do this when I finish uni, because it doesn't. I've never met a good paramedic who stopped learning after uni. Like, it's constant, right? You've got to constantly be upgrading, testing your knowledge, chatting with other people who've been through experiences, doing more courses. So there won't be a good time to start if that's your mindset. But if you use it for what it is an opportunity to put good stuff inside my head. Every now and then we need downtime. We need to sit and watch Netflix or maths or something to clear your head, whatever people are into. But if that's you 2 or 3 hours every night, I think you're kind of deadening yourself as opposed to putting some good stuff in. So I'll talk to personal development. If you want a good place to start, is set yourself routines and rituals. And this is something I'm really big on. So there's a book called Atomic Habits by a guy by the name of James Clear. And he talks about if you want to have long-term success and repeatable success in life in any area, you need to have systems and processes in place. If you just want to have short-term success, then you need to set goals. They're different things. So a goal could be, I want to lose 5 kilos. A goal could be, I want to be able to run 5Ks. They're short-term. And when they're achieved, they're achieved. But systems and processes are things like morning rituals and routines. So for me, I like to, well, let's not talk about me directly for what time you get out of bed and how much sleep you do or don't have, because I'm not a good example in that area. But if you're pressing the snooze button, which, you know, gives you that extra 9 minutes of sleep, 2 or 3 times before you get out of bed, and then you get up and you're in a rush. Now I've got to run into the shower, get my morning routine, grab my bag and run out the door to uni, to work, to whatever, then you're reacting to the world from the time you get out of bed. If you can convince yourself and set up a system to get out of bed 20 minutes earlier, and in that time I like to do some motivation, which is listen to a bit of a podcast or listen to something or read something. I like to do some movement, so I'll get a 5-minute yoga flow on YouTube for free. I don't do yoga, so it's not technical, but you just type in 5-minute yoga flow and thousands of them come up, and I just do a movement exercise. It's not about exercise, it's just about moving my body. Then I hydrate, so I'll try and drink a liter of water first thing in the morning, and that'll be in the form of a hot cup of water with some lemon infused into it, and then just plain water after that. And then I go through planning, all in 20 minutes. before I've done my shower and morning routine. And then planning is just looking at my diary, what have I got on for today? So if you're at uni, what's that look like for me today? If you've got an assignment due, what's the most important task I could be doing today? Whatever. So that's my first 20 minutes before I turn my phone on, before I do anything else. And then I go in and have my shower morning routine. And you'll walk out the door, I can guarantee, just with that extra 20 minutes, feeling much more refreshed than you will if you're reacting to the day because you're hitting that snooze button. So that's number one. Now, you could go right through nighttime routines. You could go through routines like clearing tensions, setting intentions. But my nighttime routine is my phone goes off an hour before I want to go to bed. So if I'm going to bed at 9, the phone goes off at 8. And my team in the business here know that if you send me a message after 8 o'clock, I'm not going to get it. But, you know, we're not saving lives. I'm not on Triple O. We run a gym and a personal development setup now. So they know. And I've opened my messages in the morning and found 3 or 4 group messages where someone new in the team will be messaging and Jaden or someone will say, hey, Glenn won't get this till the morning because he'll have his phone off by now. So I've trained them into what I do. So I turn my phone off, and then for that next hour, I start to either try and watch no TV or less TV, try and get away from phone, laptop, it all goes off. I'll try and do a little bit of reading just to relax my mind. I might have a shower, have a nice hot shower before I go to bed. And then 20 minutes before I go to bed, I just very quickly fill out, you know, what went well today and have a quick look over whatever my plan is for tomorrow. So a little bit of gratitude and a little bit of what's going to happen tomorrow. So those are two. Morning and night routines are the two most basic routines that you can have for personal development. Before you've even read a personal development book, before you've even listened to a podcast, just set up your routines morning and night to be more consistent so that you get a better sleep as opposed to waking up reacting to the world and then going to bed after either cramming for exams and study or watching TV and you're going to bed and your brain's just doing a million things and you don't sleep very well. Those are just two of the most basic personal development things that you can do. Get into those habits and then you can start to look at what else can I be adding in. Those habits will allow you to say, well, what's something good I could read for 10 pages in the morning or 10 pages at night before I go to bed? You don't have to read a whole chapter. I'm going to listen to 5 minutes of a personal development book or 10 minutes of a podcast. If you like it, yeah, listen to 20 minutes. You're not going to hurt you. Commit to a minimum of something. Don't take notes about it initially. Like, I'm a mad note taker. I highlight books. This is what I do. But if it's not what you do yet, just do a little bit. Just put your toe in the water and start to get a feel for it. And eventually, I think you'll start to, someone will say something and you go, actually, I listened to a podcast or I read a book or I heard this concept, and you'll help other people out. And in the process, you'll go, oh, I actually retained that information. And you'll clear a bit of brain space from all the deadening that we do and the distraction that we do through social media, emails and everything else. And you'll start to, I think, perform better at your uni. You'll start to perform better in your jobs. That's my experience anyway. So that's just a start point.
I love that. I think we're going to end it with there because that's pretty impactful. So,
and I'm a bit wordy.
No, I love it. And I feel like we could talk all day. But just so our listeners can learn a bit more about you and what you do, where are all the places that they can find you?
So I'm literally everywhere. On Facebook, we have the Building Better Humans Project. Our website's buildingbetterhumansproject.com.au. And on Instagram, I'm just under my name, Glenn Azar. So GLENNAZAR. But then we have Project 180. HQ is our gym. And Adventure Professionals is our adventure business. But all of those belong under the Building Better Humans Project. And if anyone wants to contact me through any of those platforms, whether it's myself or the team, I'll always see the message as well. So feel free to reach out, feel free to get involved. On Facebook, we do have a private group for the Building Better Humans Project. There's nothing for sale in there, and anyone can join it, but it's just where I'll sit and put some stuff that's not even online necessarily and just talk to people. I try to do that on a weekly basis, depends what I've got on. But there's, again, just find ways to surround yourself with good people, and I'm surrounded by really good people as a result.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much.